Oh, Eunice. Our reading this morning comes from the Epistles, Romans chapter 4, verses 1 to 5 and 13 to 17. For what then are we to say was gained by Abraham, our ancestor according to flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Now to one who works, wages are not reckoned as a gift, but as something due. But to one who without work trusts him, who justifies the ungodly, such faith is recognized as righteousness. For the promise that he would inherit the world did not come to Abraham or to his descendants through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. If it is the adherents of the law who are to be the heirs, faith is null and the promise is void. For the law brings wrath, and where there is no law, neither is there violation. For this reason it depends on faith, in order that the promised may rest on grace and be guaranteed to all his descendants, not only to the adherents to the law, but also to those who share the faith of Abraham. For he is the father of us all, as it is written, I have made you the father of many nations. In the presence of God, in whom he believed, he who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. This is...
People often say to me, Sandy hasn't said it, why do you give us such difficult readings? And those listening say, why do we listen to such incomprehensible material from the scriptures? I'm sure you were all riveted by the piece that Sandy read and said to yourselves, this is fantastic, I comprehend it, I understand it, it's just wonderful. Mostly, true, we go straight over this stuff because it seems as if it's not able to be understood. And also at times it just seems to be so far away. What is this kind of language? And I say that because there was a good friend of mine who, and I've mentioned this before, and a couple of other friends of mine are here this morning who will know a guy called Clive, who used to shout out from the congregation, and where will you get to from here? And the answer always came from Bruce Almighty, wait, Clive, and all will be revealed. Bruce Almighty, you okay with that one? Good, yes. Someone stole my poster of that, by the way. I had them all over the place, over the church, over my room, and they're all missing. All of you travelled this morning to this place in a vehicle with wheels. Anyone not do that? Okay, you walk, Barry. Go. Okay, Barry and Margaret can go home now. The wheel is a terrific invention, and it's been incredibly popular since its invention some 7,000 or so years ago by the Sumerians. So from Sumerian carts to Australian cars, wheels have kept us moving, and they are absolutely critical to almost every form of transport, whether it be planes, trains, cars, bicycles, and so on. But wheels have a difficulty that has persisted since their invention. It's a difficulty that's been with us who use them for the 7,000 years. Even though wheels, and we saw this with the Tour Down Under, are getting lighter, are getting faster, stronger, sleeker, and all the rest of it, wheels have one particular problem, and the problem is... No. No, the problem is their roundness. The one big problem about wheels is their roundness. Fold up a bicycle, and how small can you make it? The size of the wheel. And it's the same for wheelchairs. was talking to Barbara this morning. They're talking about getting walkers and wheelchairs on aeroplanes and so on. You might want to collapse a wheelchair, but you know that wheelchairs do have large wheels. And when you fold a wheelchair, you can collapse it quite well, you cannot get the wheelchair any smaller than the wheel. Until now, at the end of 2013, a guy who had a parent who was having to use a wheelchair had a great amount of difficulty folding the wheelchair, putting it into the boot of the car, travelling with the parent on a plane where you can't get the wheelchair in the overhead bin and all the rest of it. He was a cycling enthusiast and he wanted to invent, in his own way, a smaller, foldable bicycle. And then he realised that handicapped people like his parent would be helped if they also could collapse and make smaller their wheelchairs. For the large spoked wheels of wheelchairs are almost universally cumbersome. So he invented morph wheels. And morph wheels is to get the normal sized wheelchair wheels, which are about 60 centimetres, to half that size. These wheels are narrow enough to fit in the back of a taxi, and they can go into the overhead bin in an aeroplane. They're made of glass-filled nylon and can be attached to any wheelchair with a quick-release axle. Betty, can we have a picture of... Okay, that's the wheel. That's the morph wheel, design of the year 2013. You probably think that it can't work, but in actual fact, it does. What you've done is make a large round wheel into a long, thin piece, which does fit, because he measured it, the overhead bin in an aeroplane. Thank you. So after 7,000 years, the wheel has been reinvented. So, here's the deal. Let's just remove that picture and listen to my wisdom. According to St. Paul, we all want to travel on a particular road. And that road is the road of holiness. And we've been accustomed to doing that in the church and also outside the church by slapping on, let's go with the image, the wheels of right living and law-abiding observance of the laws of the land and particularly the commandments of God. As we should. I don't have any problem with that, and I'm sure you don't either. But Jesus comes into the picture with a whole new idea. And if we can run with the foldable wheel bit, he folds this wheel of righteous living in halves. And he does something radical. He doesn't get rid of the wheel that is doing the right thing and obeying the commandments of God. But what he does do is invite a whole new perspective. Now, you need to bear with me as you were kind listening to Sandy read the piece from St. Paul. For thousands of years, the term righteousness has been associated with the list of things that people were supposed to do. You know, righteous men and righteous women were those who did or tried to do everything on the list of being good. If you take bits of the Old Testament from Psalm 119, we shared a bit of it this morning, it has the line, "Your righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your law is the truth." And then a whole smattering from Proverbs. "The righteous," that's people, "hate falsehood. The thoughts of the righteous are just. The desire of the righteous ends only in good. The righteous do the right." So righteousness means doing right, good, proper things. When we behave this way, we're told everything ends in good and we are good. If you do the right thing, then you are good. In other words, we're trying to get to heaven, riding to glory, if you like, on wheels of law and order and all those other good things, snapped onto some kind of axle of obedience. Do the right thing and you'll get to heaven. Problem is, if you're anything like me, you'll experience an inner conflict. The conflict between what you know to be the law of God and that other terrible old phrase which we don't use much anymore, the law of sin. And instead of doing good or the right thing, so often we do that which is not right or not good or that which is evil. So instead of being righteous, we behave in ways that are unrighteous. And next week I'll try and beat this a little bit more with this verse from St. Paul, which I think sums up all of us. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. And that's pretty well the basis of what it is to be human. So there has to be a better way. How do we deal with this wheel of righteousness? St. Paul responds by reinventing the wheel, by folding the wheel, if you like. And he uses the example of Abraham, which when we heard this morning and put us all off and we didn't listen to it because it was just too darn difficult. It's probably being fair. Because he says, what then are we to say about our ancestor Abraham? I mean, you've always got to point to someone who is really important to try and justify, thank you, Archer, try and justify the particular view. He says, what are we to say about him according to the flesh? He says, if Abraham was justified by works, that's what he did, the good things that he did, then Abraham can boast about how good he is because of the good things that he did. But Paul is aware that those who saw the righteousness of Abraham understood that it wasn't necessarily in his acceptance by God the things that he did. So Paul grabs this old wheel and collapses it and says, Abraham believed God, trusted in God, loved God, and that to him was righteousness. So it's not what Abraham did that made him acceptable by God. It was Abraham's faith which made him acceptable by God. Now, my two friends, Barry and David, have heard me use Bruce's extreme example before, and I'm going to put it to you now. How is it that we can be accepted by God? What do we have to do to be accepted by God? 99.9% of people will make a list of things that need to be done. I need to live better, I need to be kinder, I need to this, I need to that, and all the rest of it. A list of things. Righteous, do good things. The answer to being accepted by God, here it comes, bear with me, is simply to accept the fact that you are accepted. Nothing is required of you. No good works, no massive gifts, no nothing, which is a tautology. Simply accept the fact that you are accepted. When we accept the fact that we are accepted, that then becomes the motivation to do something good. You don't have to do something good in order to be accepted. I mean, what do we say about Archer? Archer will love you only if you don't cry, if you behave, if you don't put on a turn, if you don't dirty your nappy. Do we lay a whole lot of conditions in front of him and say, fulfill all of these, Archer, and you're accepted. We'll love you. We'll be your parents. Don't do them, and we'll give them to your grand... No. Who'd probably welcome him anyway. We say, we love you. We accept you just as you are. No conditions. You don't have to pass any tests. You don't have to do anything. Just because you are, we love you. Then later on, we hope that he will not put on a temper tantrum and all the other things that belong. And that's what St. Paul says is the new will. Suddenly, everyone can gain righteousness. Everyone can experience God's forgiveness. Everyone can be with God, even if we have excuse the phrase, stuffed up and made mistakes and all the rest of it in life and still are making problems. The cumbersome wheel of righteousness and devotion and all the rest of it has collapsed and people are accepted just as they are. So Paul says Abraham had faith, and it was the willingness of his faith that made him right with God, not the things that he did. And when you think about that, this little section from Romans suddenly becomes incredibly important in understanding who we are as human beings. So Paul is emphasizing a person is justified, forgiven, received by God because of that person's acceptance of God, which is to say faith, apart from any works that have been prescribed. So what does it feel like or to ride this reinvented wheel? One Benedictine nun says, it's beyond denominational purity, more than religious devotion, more than saintly rigour. Faith rests in the arms of God, trusts today and accepts tomorrow, because faith knows whatever the day, God is in it and I'm loved. Our faith is not about purity. It's not about our devotion. It's not about our rigour. It's not about what we do. Instead, it's a willingness to just rest in God's arms because God accepts us. It's a decision to trust Jesus and go with that. And when we have this kind of faith, we're made right with God. We trust God to work in us, even if we get older and our bodies fail us or we forget to do things. We trust Jesus to lead us, even though we may wander consciously and unconsciously through a thicket of very, very difficult moral choices. We trust the Holy Spirit to uplift us, even when our friends and family may disappoint us, when our careers may crash, when everything may seem like it's on fire. Being righteous doesn't mean moral perfection. Instead, it's taking a ride on the wheel of faith. So what do our lives look like? Well, Martin Luther clicked onto it once. He said, good works does not make a good man / woman, but a good man or a good woman does good works. He knew that our faith is what makes us acceptable to God, not just the things that we do. Sure, good Christians practice compassion, they are kind, they are humble, patient, loving, forgiving and all the rest of it. We do all of those things. We do those things not because we are wonderful people, but simply because God has accepted us. So the wheel of faithful living is turned around. It's reinvented by St. Paul, that in this strange bundle of verses that Sandy stumbled through this morning, we see what it is to be made righteous through faith. And the way in which we have shared with Archer this morning, it is simply that which gives us the vision. We accept him, we love him, we include him, we don't ask of him that he pass this test or reach this point or have these particular ticks or whatever. He is simply accepted and loved, nurtured, cherished as he is. And that is exactly how God accepts us, loves us and believes in us. Later on, of course, you would hope that as a result of that, he and we do good things. Let's sing again. This time the hymn, Giving Respect to Humankind.